Hi, I'm Rich Eisworth, President and General Manager of Cincinnati Public Radio, and I'm sitting in Studio B with the incredible and unbelievable Thane Maynard of the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Gardens, and of course, host, producer, and energy behind the 92nd Naturalist. Hi, Thane.
Rich, always good to be with you, and it's always fun to be down at Cincinnati Public Radio.
Thane, I've got a bunch of questions here to ask, and we have limited time, so let's just get right into it. You've been hosting and writing the 92nd Naturalist for more than 30 years,
yeah.
Hard to believe. All right, how did the program start, and what keeps it, let's say, fresh for you?
Well, when I joined the zoo business years ago, the reason was zoos reach everybody, right? Everybody that listens to the radio, everybody that goes to Kroger comes to the zoo. So you don't have to already be a member of the Sierra Club. You don't have to drive a Subaru. Just everybody comes. And it's a great way to reach the general public with information about wildlife and what conservation's about and why it's important. And, of course, the same thing's true with radio. You know, we reach a big, broad audience with our story. So for me, it began as a way to extend what I do at the zoo, you know, and what we do, which is telling the story of wildlife, to the same audience, but even a bigger audience at time and different people. So that piece of it has been an awful lot of fun. And the idea began in Madison, Wisconsin in 1987. I heard the famous Harvard behavioral biologist E.O. Wilson speak. And as he said, he was entering the narrative phase of his career. So he didn't give a science talk. He gave a talk about the importance of taking conservation and biodiversity to the public. And he even said, you know, we need newspaper articles, television shows, radio shows about nature. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to grow up to be a scientist, but I could tell stories about nature. So next thing that happened, we launched it in 87, and it's been on ever since.
Now, over 30 years, there have to be a couple episodes at least, I would hope, that are your favorites. Do you recall any of them?
Well, as you know, I do get feedback, and feedback tends to circle on a few things. Some people think I talk too much about animal poop. Some things people think I talk too much about animal mating. There are certain animals that really get people going, such as wolves. You know, the show airs all over the country. And so I hear from ranchers out west who are like, son, you sound like an Easterner when you talk about wolves, that sort of thing. Probably the ones that are my favorite are every April Fool's Day, we do one that's a spoof. And we try to make it sound realistic. And typically it doesn't fool everybody. But typically it does fool one or two experts. So one time I did one on a fictitious subspecies of mammal. And if you listened carefully, you would have known by the end it was sort of a spoof. But if you're in your car and you hear a little bit of information and you're an expert on those mammals, and this was a type of, rodent from the forests of Thailand, that kind of thing. And I get an email immediately. Some guy writes in about 7 in the morning. I am an expert on that genus of animals and everything you said was false. And you know, you write back and say, well, here's a version of it if you listen again. And if you check your calendar, it'd probably all work out. And then they write back, hey, sorry, I get it. You know, that kind of thing.
It's nice to know that even scientists have a sense of humor. You may have to dig pretty deep for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, of course, we're certainly honored to have you as part of the Cincinnati Public Radio family, but your full-time gig, as we keep reminding people, is director of the zoo, which means that you're in charge of more than 500 animals?
Sure. Well, absolutely more than that. More than 500 species of animals, because we have 109 species just of insects and invertebrates in our insect building.
And then about how many plant species?
Well, even more species than that. You know, there's an irony because of the irreplaceable character of large trees. The plants are more valuable than the animals at our zoo, which sounds crazy. I mean, you can't always put a dollar value on it, but as amazing and valuable as an elephant is, you could get another elephant. But a 150-year-old oak tree, you're not going to get another one for 150 years. So it's interesting. We are not nearly as well known for our botanical garden, but we're one of only two accredited gardens in the state of Ohio, which means we have a great big public garden, education program, scientific research programs, field conservation programs for plants. And it's an important part of who we are. And certainly, the beautiful gardens are a part of our tradition. The zoo was founded in 1873 by German immigrants, and they were trying to replicate what they had in places like the Stuttgart Zoo and the Frankfurt Zoo in the Victorian era of Germany. And they wanted a beautiful urban garden filled with wildlife that had cultural events. And our title was the Cincinnati Zoological Garden. And it's much the same way today. We have those same things, you know. We have a lot more events. They're probably less formal. As you know, we were home to the opera from 1920 to 1973. And now we bring in, you know, local rock bands, but, you know, it's culture.
Well, it's not over until the fat elephant sings.
See.
What's apart from the 90-second naturalist, in terms of your zoo gig, what do you find the most challenging part of that job?
Well, you know, the zoo's a business like everywhere, so we have to figure out, okay, how are we going to make sure that we are viable in this community, that we are offering what people want, and that that continues to succeed. You know, this is not a tourist town like San Diego or Washington, D.C., where they have big zoos. It's not a good weather town. Half the time, the weather's bad. So we're open all year long, so how are we going to make that work? And we do it by trying real hard, right? We, more than most zoos, have a lot of activities for visitors. We call ours wild encounters. And so if you're walking through the zoo, you might have a random encounter with a flock of flamingos that somebody's walking by with, or some miniature pigs, or we have a kids show in the children's zoo where they race chickens. I mean, we do all kinds of things. And the goal is to have people say, well, you know, that was a lot of fun. I ought to join the zoo and go back more than once.
So what's the most rewarding part then of the zoo work?
You know, that's an interesting thing that has evolved over time. And I don't know if this has happened in your career, but you and I are old enough that we have a lot of perspective on this. I entered the zoo field for sure because I wanted to help tell the story of wildlife. Zoos reach people. We're going to help get that message of conservation out. And that's still true today, and our zoo does that well. But what I do find rewarding, I'll admit, having represented the zoo for so long, is I'll be out jogging in an urban neighborhood like Avondale where I live, or I'll be at the grocery store, and people stop me all the way from the west side to the east side, and they say, you know, the zoo's so important to my family. My kids went to zoo camp. My daughter grew up to be a veterinarian, or my favorite animal is Fiona. I mean, everybody has a zoo story in this town. And we're fortunate that way. You know, some towns, Pittsburgh is a football town. There's no two ways about it. Cincinnati's a zoo town. And so we're lucky that way. We've been here a long time.
You have a better record, I think, than the Bengals. Now, the zoo's known all over the world as the greenest zoo in America. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we don't just mean moss. What are some examples of the strategies you've used to reduce the zoo's impact on the environment?
You know, that has been a remarkable win-win success. It really has. In 2006, we hired a civil engineer from Turner Construction named Mark Fisher, and he was going to run our facilities, and he was going to improve the grounds, and he was going to help build the new buildings. On his very first day, he walks into my office with a piece of paper, and he says, have you seen the water bill? And I said, oh, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? It keeps going up, blah, blah, blah. He's like, dude, if you turned on every faucet in the zoo full blast, you couldn't use half this water. There's a lot of broken stuff at this zoo. Well, sure enough, we're busy, like a farmer. Like, okay, we got to keep going, got to keep going. Well, yeah, there are broken pipes underground, just old systems. We used to have bad behavioral systems, too, where keepers would use sort of a pressure washer to clean the sidewalks out in front of their buildings. Well, today they use, you know, a leaf blower, which works just as well and doesn't waste gallons and gallons of water every day of the year. Well, we've gone from being the biggest waster of water in the Metropolitan Sewer District and the biggest user in 06 to using only 1/6 that water. So what's that look like? We used 220 million gallons of tap water in 06. We're down to 40 million now.
Holy cow.
The zoo's 25% bigger as we expand our parking. We have more waterfalls, more moats, more hippos to swim. So how do we do it? Well, the answer is they swim and we irrigate and we create waterfalls with rainwater. We catch huge amounts of rainwater under our big parking lot and under our new Africa exhibit and then are able to repurpose that water. It works great for a bunch of reasons. One is it keeps that water off the storm water grid because we have these combined sewers. It can be a problem. And frankly, it just saves a ton of money. Oh, my goodness. And we've been able to reinvest that money in other sustainable things. So our parking lot, you park under solar panels that provide 25% of our electricity. We're putting really upgraded both HVAC and lighting systems throughout the zoo. And over time, because of the water savings, it's actually paid for itself. And in the long run has huge payoffs, both obviously with our carbon footprint, but also out of pocket.
Now, as director of the zoo, I know you do a lot of traveling around the world. So I have to ask, what has been your favorite place to visit outside of Cincinnati?
Yeah, exactly, outside of Cincinnati Public Radio. I have been fortunate to go a lot of places. Most frequently, I've probably gone to East and Southern Africa because those are the places of great legend, you know. Westerners, when we think of the wild, we think of the plains of Africa and the big animals that are there. But my most recent big trip last spring was to the Congo. And boy, I'll tell you what, that is something. National Geographic calls it the last place on Earth. and it is remote. It is tough. If they dropped me off there and I stayed for long, I probably wouldn't make it out. I mean, it is virulent. There are parasites of every type, obviously viruses and bacteria that aren't other places. The people that actually live there, these guys that were at these field camps who live there and work, they are tough. They are really tough. They don't have any shoes. They are out there every single day. I mean, you know how Americans travel. I mean, all I carried was a water bottle and a pair of binoculars. I was sweating and nearly dying, and bugs are stuck on my head. The guys that live there pick up all the weight and just keep going. But it was remarkable to see these big national parks, a string of them that are from the Democratic Republic of Congo through the Republic of Congo down to Gabon, that have been protected just in the last 25 years. And without those, the whole thing would be a logging concession. Outside those parks, we saw logging concessions, and those need to be controlled. But it is such a lush and humid place, it's hard to imagine that it won't still be forests hundreds of years from now, because it would not be the first place somebody would say, I've got an idea, let's build a town here. I mean, it would be a tough place to settle a town. So it was heartening. It was scary. And we saw people doing really good conservation work. I went because our zoo, since the 1990s, has partnered with and been supportive of conservation in those very parks. And frankly, it grew out of their big loss from 2016 when we lost Harambe, our gorilla. We committed to not let him die in vain. So we said we're going to double the space for gorillas at our zoo, which we've done, built a $13 million facility. And we're going to double our commitment to conservation in the Congo. And also, I wanted to go and see what we're doing there and visit with those people. And it's a remarkable story. It is. It's not an easy place for conservation to work.
You mentioned places you've been. Any place on your bucket list that you haven't gone to yet?
There are. Yeah, there are. I would love to go to the Pantanal, which is that open grassland area in Brazil where you can see on a single day jaguars and tapirs and giant otters. And those would be from boat, you know. It's a wetland grassland area. You'd also see maybe 8 different species of monkeys. So I'd love to get down there, and I haven't been. Less for wildlife, but for beauty, I'd love to go to New Zealand, because all I've ever heard is it looks like the Tetons, but everybody has an accent.
And it helps if you're a fan of Lord of the Rings, I guess.
See, there you go.
But speaking of traveling, I know that your association with an identity with the 92nd Naturalist, if it hasn't brought you fortune, it has brought you a certain amount of fame. I know that you've regaled me with some stories of your instantly recognizable voice being recognized out west.
Well, you know, it's a sweet thing. I'm a devotee of the spoken word, so it's of interest to me to have a show like this. And, of course, there's so many great voices that you'll hear on public radio. You know, thanks to you, I got to have dinner this year with Ira Flatow, who, I mean, gosh, he was exactly like I expected. He really was. Rimless glasses, a guy from the Bronx or Brooklyn. He was just perfect. In my case, it's true. I joke we're number one in Billings, Montana, because I went out there to give a talk at a beautiful museum called the Museum of the Rockies, which is at Montana State. And I'm in downtown. There's not much shaking. And I say, hi there, could I have a cup of coffee? And this woman says, aren't you that guy on the radio who talks about animals? And I said, are you kidding? This is phenomenal. Yeah, so that's cute.
You're the biggest thing in Billings.
That's right.
You mentioned Harambe. We share with your sorrow over the loss of that magnificent creature. But on the flip side, we, of course, can't talk about the zoo without mentioning Fiona.
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing survival story that was. You must be so proud of the people you work with who work so hard for a happy ending there. Were you and the zoo at all prepared for the media frenzy that Fiona caused?
You know, it has been more than anybody could have expected. It really has. You know, we went from the year before being in the top 3 or 4 among American zoos on our social media use. You know, there's ways to measure that. So Instagram and Facebook and all that. And big ones were like San Diego Zoo, for instance. Well, with Fiona, I mean, we left them, it's insane to say we left them in the dust. I mean, we left them tenfold in the dust. You know, just overall hundreds of millions of people between watching the Facebook movies and the daily Instagrams and others. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, American productivity fell like a rock because of that baby hippo. But I'll tell you, it was quite a story. I was there the day that she was born. You know, we heard about it. We were all called in. The zoo has remote cameras, so that's how they saw that it was coming. And it was a surprise, of course, because she was 6 to 8 weeks early. And I'm standing there and looking in, and here's some straw, and here's this little baby that, you know, is supposed to be this giant-sized 100-pound watermelon, you know, precocious and diving underwater and nursing on its mom. Instead, it's just laying there on the straw like a deflated football. And I'm thinking, oh, man. And one young keeper says to another, they're looking into, and she says, we can do this. And I'll be honest, I thought, oh, man, these girls are going to get their heart broken because nobody'd ever done anything like this. Nobody had ever milked a hippo. We had to get milk. You know, nobody'd ever raised a premature baby hippo. I'm not even sure anybody had ever seen a live premature baby hippo because they're normally born underwater. And where they live in Africa, it's very dark water, dirty water. You wouldn't even see if a baby was there and didn't pop up. So one of the reasons people love her so much is no one's ever seen a cute baby hippo before, right? She's bouncing around in the clear water. And of course, the come from behind story, man alive. Yeah, they went the distance. People not only slept in the room with her, they slept and held her to help keep her warm.
Yeah, we've all seen the videos.
For weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
And you had Cincinnati Children's Hospital help out too there.
They did indeed. Yeah, they're our neighbors and great friends and supporters of the zoo. They've helped us on lots of things over the years. But in this case, it was someone in our marketing department, a young mom who, you know, heard that, gosh, Fiona's not doing well. She's getting dehydrated, has, you know, diarrhea, and we got to give her fluids. And even though she's a baby, she's fat, right? You can see our veins. You can't see hippo's veins. And this young woman said, well, when my daughter was at the hospital and they couldn't hit a vein, they called in this special SWAT team of nurses called the vascular access team, and they got it done. And I'm not kidding. Two women came over in a children's van, got out like SEAL Team 6, said, get out of the way. There's never been a vein we can't hit. And they did it. I mean, it was crazy. In fact, they had to do it twice because she pulled it out once. But it stayed in, and she gained weight ever since. And she's going to be 1,000 pounds soon. You know, on December 1st, we're going to have a fun fundraiser celebration called the Fiona 1K. And so it's a 1 kilometer walk or run. And hopefully she'll be right about 1,000 pounds then.
Cool. Now, speaking of Fiona, I know she's had a number of propositions from eligible hippos around the country.
I know.
Any wedding bells that we should be aware of?
Well, there aren't yet. She certainly wouldn't be sort of mature enough and fertile enough until 4 or 5 years old. We may wait that long or longer.
So a long engagement.
Yeah. Well, zoos trade animals back and forth all the time for genetic reasons. And their organization, you know, things called Species Survival Plan, where experts say, okay, this one should go here. It's like Match.com for hippos.
But swipe right for
exactly.
The, yeah, I've got it.
But in this case, we're going to play, you know, the franchise player card and not let her go. So they'll have to send a mail here. We're not sending her there.
I don't want to see what the dowry will be.
I know.
You spend all day with animals, either at the zoo or here at the station. Mm-hmm. You know, the two-legged kind here and the four-legged or multiple-legged kind you have at the zoo. But when you go home at night, aside from your lovely wife, any other creatures are keeping you company?
I mean, we do. We have a cat and a dog. Our cat's lived with us a long time. He's over 17 years old. And, you know, he's getting old and skinny, but he's a good guy. His name is Puck, and he's my great friend. At night when I sit and read, he sits right there with me. And he bugs my wife a little bit. But we also have a dog. And like lots of people who are empty nesters, kids are growing up, man, that dog is a big deal at our house. Her name's Sophie. And she gets whatever she wants. And, you know, a friend of mine who's a veterinarian, who's done it a long time, he says, it took me a long time to realize with, you know, my the owners of my pets that the owners care a lot more about the dog than they do about their spouse. And it sounds corny, but I'm telling you. Yeah.
I know in your wife's case. That's
I know. Sophie gets a pass about anything.
Well, we mentioned, Kathleen, you have some daughters.
And we do, yeah.
What are they doing?
Well, you know, it's fun. They grew up at the zoo, taking zoo camp and doing all those programs. And sure enough, 2 out of 3 became biologists. Yeah, so my oldest is a cancer researcher down at the University of Texas. And my youngest is a zoo person, broke in to the field at Disney's Animal Kingdom in Orlando. So that's fun. My middle daughter lives here in town, and she's an artist and an entrepreneur and has a brand and does all kinds of things. So they're all a lot of fun to be with.
So in spite of the wrong turn their father took, they can end up being a success. What is something that people always assume about you that is absolutely wrong? Apart, I'm not going to. Don't ask me what I assume about you. We already know what that is.
Yeah, that's hard to know. Well, people would assume, gosh, Thane knows everything about animals, but there's a lot to learn. And you can get your comeuppance. For instance, we've all met young kids who know an awful lot about dinosaurs, right? That's a thing that happens. Well, there are some kids, even sometimes some kids on the spectrum who, I am not kidding you, the kid starts talking to you like, who is that kid? I mean, he actually does know more about animals than I do, and he's 8 years old, right? I mean, there are just some people that are really, really gifted. And the same thing's true with skills in natural history. I've known, been lucky to know some people that are like world-class bird watchers. Holy moly. You just go on a brief walk in the springtime and they'll say, well, yeah, I saw and heard 73 species of birds. And these aren't people making stuff up like you and I do. I mean, these guys are pros. So there's always more to learn in nature.
Well, you've rubbed shoulders with a lot of people at the zoo and through your association nationally and co-authors of books with you. So I imagine you've picked up a lot of information through osmosis, if not directly.
Well, you know, it is a sweet thing. Zoos bring a lot of things to the community they're in. And charmingly, most towns that have a zoo love their hometown zoo, right? Just like wherever you went to school, you love that school. You don't care if everybody else went somewhere fancier. You love your school. And at our zoo, we do bring lots of biologists, conservationists, thought leaders in the field to town. We do an annual lecture series. And that's a heartening thing, you know, to meet people that are the real leaders in the field who've done it a long time. Most of them have still remained hopeful, even in the face of so many challenges. So that's been a heartening thing.
I got a question for you, going back to your shady past. Had you always had this fascination with animals? I knew you grew up in Florida, so you wrestled alligators.
It's true.
But at what point did you decide you wanted to get in the zoo biz?
Well, mine is sort of a tale of a mint spit. Excuse me.
Easy for you to say. Youth.
That's right. I was that last generation that grew up in Florida before air conditioning. And as a result, it was just hot. And you and I are old enough to remember, nobody used to do anything, right? Today, everybody, oh, we're taking the family here, we're flying there. Nobody did that. We sat around all summer, you know, trying to take a pine needle and see if we could squish it into the asphalt because the asphalt was so hot it was molten, right? That was summer's entertainment. So the result was kids were outside all the time. And in Florida, where it's hot, they would go down to any body of water, a lake or a stream, because once you're wet, you're not hot anymore. So we did catch a lot of snakes and a lot of turtles, and we tried to catch baby alligators, but blessedly, they were pretty rare. They'd been hunted out. Because if you were doing those same antics today, be careful. There's a lot of alligators. And we used to swim in the dark and do all kinds of things you would never do in Florida today. And that did lead to me studying biology in college. And I had not planned on a zoo career. I went to grad school at the School of Natural Resources at Michigan. And I assumed I would, you know, go to Africa and get a Land Rover or join the Fish and Wildlife Service and go to Alaska or something like that. But my college girlfriend tracked me down in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we got married. And she's from Cincinnati and had a job here. And one day I woke up and said, I should probably get a job, right? I'm not going to get to get a Land Rover. And right place at the right time, which is true in a lot of people's careers. The zoo was building the world's first education center at a zoo. It was funded by Procter & Gamble, and they needed someone to help lead programs, and one thing led to the next, yeah.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. But getting back to your career and your part-time career with public radio, do you have a favorite public radio show outside of the 92nd Naturalist?
Well, I do love Science Friday. I think Ira Flatow's got that great sort of, oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this one kind of thing. So that's neat. It keeps it going. I assume everybody's favorite is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I mean, come on, Peter Sagal and the way he does that Kermit the Frog. Oh my God. It's incredible, that show. I love it. Paula Poundstone, the whole crowd. They even survived Carl Castle retiring.
Yeah.
And some people thought they might not. I very much look forward to that show. Scott Simon, Saturday mornings, just terrific. Just terrific. I'm off most Saturday mornings. I'll listen to that when I'm working on a project or driving my car somewhere. The most memorable, even though I've had so many good memories of stories and such on public radio, the most memorable earlier this year, he was doing an interview with a young woman in Southwest Ohio about opioids.
Yeah.
And she's telling her story, and he starts weeping openly. And I pulled my car over to the curb. I'm like, I'm not even believing this. And he just said, you know, I know I'm a reporter, but I'm a father too. And this isn't your fault. And boy, it was something.
Yeah.
It was something. And I don't know him, but he's darn good at what he does. The Saturday morning show is great.
You have any guilty pleasure that you'd care to admit to?
I don't know. Probably I don't know, I eat too much. I run yeah, around right. a lot.
You don't run around a lot. But in an exercise way, we don't want to misinterpret what around running yeah, exactly. around is okay. Yeah. Do you have a favorite band?
Well, you know, I grew up as a folkie, and so I kind of missed the whole rock and roll thing, except it was all part of our experience growing up, but I didn't, you know, have as many, you know, Rolling Stone albums as I did Pete Seeger. So I love acoustic music, and this town's great. A lot of good acoustic musicians come through town. And if a person for a period of decades has made a living with a six-string guitar by themselves, they got to have some stage presence because that's not bringing too much. So I enjoy just those single performers that come through. You know, Livingston Taylor will play the Ludlow Garage or in their heyday. Gosh, yeah, Nancy Griffith, who's now not well and not touring, but I saw her at Bogart's first time years ago. I'm like, man, it was great. It's like she was at the Texas State Fair and there were only about 100 people there.
Well, you don't play any instrument yourself, do you?
Certainly not well. Like everybody in college, I played some guitar and banjo, but I took lessons once and a friend of mine, Greg Joasis, who's a local musician, after about 5 lessons said, did your family ever have music on when you were a child? Because, you know, it's supposed to have a rhythm, like a 3/4 thing. I said, no. He said, well, no kidding. Yeah. Like, you got nothing.
You were atonal.
That's terrible. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite movie you've seen several times? I know you don't go to the movies much.
I don't know why we don't. We don't go to a lot of movies, but I always enjoy them when I see them.
Don't say Free Willy.
It wasn't Free Willy. No, you know, I'll tell you what. There was a film we saw years ago that was so terrific. And I do admit, I like sort of B movies that don't have a lot of advertising and hoopla. You just see it and you're like, well, that was pretty good, wasn't it? Anyway, it was a John Travolta movie called A Love Song for Bobby Long. And it's based on the book called Off Magazine Street, which was autobiographical and a novel from a professor that retired at Auburn University. So it's about a fallen from grace alcoholic Auburn University English professor who's still brilliant but full of angst. It takes place in New Orleans. It's just great.
You identify with the lead character, no doubt.
No, since we're on New Orleans, another great one that shocked me was Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh.
Also, it was a post-Katrina tale from New Orleans.
Right.
All the people in it were not actors.
Right.
And one of them got nominated for an Academy Award. I mean, it was a terrific movie.
Through your career at the zoo and the 30 years plus now with the 92nd Naturalist, you've had a chance to meet and talk to a good number of people. Is there one person currently alive that you haven't met or talked to that you'd really like to meet? And it doesn't need to be anybody in the sciences mm-hmm. or in associated with animals. Just, is there somebody that you would give your right eye tooth for?
You know, that's an interesting question because when you started, I was thinking that you enjoyed meeting. And we have been fortunate. David Attenborough came to our zoo to film, and I enjoyed being with him immensely. I mean, the man invented natural history interpretation on electronic media. And of course, Jane Goodall, I've been lucky to work with her, and both of them are one of a kind. That I haven't met, gosh, I'd have to think on that. I'm not sure. I don't know many, you know, movie stars or sports figures, so it probably would be somebody involved with science and conservation. There's only a few, we have a lecture series, there's only a few people that have turned us down, and one was Attenborough. He's been to the zoo, but he doesn't like to go out and give talks.
Oh, really? That's surprising.
Well, he's so famous. I think he's just worn out. Another who lives near here in central Kentucky was Wendell Berry, the poet of Kentucky. He sent me a charming postcard that said, "Dear Mr. Maynard, I have real work to do on my farm. I hope you have important work where you are, too."
That's a very generous way of turning you down.
Exactly. He wanted to write it in a way that I wouldn't keep bothering him.
Yeah. And it worked.
It did.
It did. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer. I want to thank you, Thane, for your time, for your investment, for your interest, for your support, for the entertainment and education you provided to listeners all these years. And, of course, for being such a wonderful ambassador, not only of the Cincinnati Zoo, but also Cincinnati Public Radio. It's fun having you here.
Well, thanks. It's fun to be here. And everybody listening, you know, we all enjoy these stations, and we should all support them as well. I think a little bit public radio gets taken for granted. It's been there forever, and there it is. And it isn't perceived as, wow, well, that's either a charity or something that needs support to succeed. So don't forget that. And you guys are building new headquarters.
We hope so. I think you're doing some construction allegedly at the zoo, too, right?
It's always something.
A little project, yeah.
That gives you and me something to do.
All right. Well, keep an eye on Fiona for us all.
That I will do.
Thanks.
Thanks.